that the mental obsession is beyond human aid and it's beyond willpower. It is something that's very, very subtle, and that's why we almost always die, because it's just something that's beyond our understanding. Why do we pick up a drink knowing what we know, being in as many rehabs as we've been in, having as many DWIs, losing as many families? It's the most insane thing in the world. So we can't think about it. It just has to be an action that comes. Now, there are a lot of times where the slip precedes the drink, you know. I believe that also. But I also believe that when you're not in a fit spiritual condition, you're rolling the dice, you know. You can get struck drunk. Because the big book spends chapters telling me that. Anyway, if you are satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't at this stage refer to the book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can if he's not too alcoholic. But insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover himself. If you have not lost the power to control your drinking, you may be able to use willpower and stay away from alcohol. And that's all well and fine. But I'll tell you, I was way past that point in my own drinking. I was way past the point of where I could decide whether or not to drink. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. It's funny. People who catch alcoholism, people who come into these rooms and identify with alcoholism and learn about it, survive it. People who don't know they have alcoholism die from it. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him he is an alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he's become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question if he will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Talk about how you went through the steps. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be atheist or agnostic, make it empathetic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. You know, try to help him get over their prejudice of organized religion and all that stuff. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. Your prospect may belong to a religious denomination. His religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he's going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to work so well. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. This is a great sentence to be vital. Faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. So that's an important instruction there. Let him see that you are not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you, but call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. Perhaps your story will help him see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. We represent no particular faith or denomination. We're dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you did a fourth step, how you straightened out your past, how you did a ninth step, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him, and what a 12th step is. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him, especially if he's in a blackout and he won't remember you even being there. make it plain he's under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Mm. My first sponsor told me that, you know, there's no way I could ever repay the debt that I owe Fish Food Phil. You know what I mean? There's some people in here that remember Phil. Yeah. He kept me alive until I could keep myself alive with God's help, you know. And I could never repay him. What could I do for him? He's living a great life. He told me, you pay me back by working with other people. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. That's a great one. You have to place the welfare of other people ahead of your own. You know? And you still hear things in the rooms like, I gotta learn to start loving myself more. You know what I mean? Place the welfare of other people before your own. That's what recovery is. Make it clear that he's not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he's helped you more than you've helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe if you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. A lot of 12-step calls, the person does not get sober right away. But I'll tell you what, if you've done a good 12-step call, you're gonna make a haunted person. You know, that person is never going to enjoy a double bourbon and coke again. You know, this is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. Your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all of your program. Pay the money back? No way. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people. Tell all my secrets? Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he does, but you doubt whether you would have made much progress had you not taken action. On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he shows interest, lend him your copy of this book. So on a 12-step call, what are you supposed to have with you? You're supposed to have a book with you. Unless your friend wants to talk further about himself, do not wear out your welcome. Give him a chance to think it over. If you do stay, let him steer the conversation in any direction he likes. Sometimes a new man is anxious to proceed at once. They want to do the whole 12 steps right that day. And you may be tempted to let him do so. This is sometimes a mistake. If he has trouble later, he is likely to say you rushed him. You will be most successful with alcoholics if you do not exhibit any passion for crusade or reform. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. Show him how they worked with you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him if he wants to get well, you will do anything to help. And we absolutely will. We'll do anything for the willing person. Watch a willing person come into Alcoholics Anonymous. He'll do anything you tell him to do. Wants to recover like crazy. That person, unbelievable good luck will follow that person around. They'll get vehicles and jobs. You know what I mean? Check out the person who's not willing to do anything. You know, they're like Joe Shlobotnik, that guy on the old milk carton covers with the cloud over their head. I swear to God, it's like it's karma or something. If he is not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. I had to drop somebody this weekend. I've been working with this guy for a long, long time. He's not willing to do anything. And with the help of my sponsor, we had to sever our relationship. It was not doing him any good. It was not doing me any good to have this person continue to keep crying out for help, but have absolutely no willingness to follow suggestion. It was driving me crazy and everybody around me, and it was certainly not doing the person any good. So basically, we told him, the next phone call we get from you, you better be willing to go into a detox and get detoxed. Otherwise, don't bother calling. So sometimes you have to drop him, and it's not something I do lightly, I'll tell you. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read the book in the interval. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. I use the Bill Wilson exercise in this for the newer people that I sponsor. And what that is I ask him to read Bill's story, and the first 8 pages of Bill's story underline any drinking, thinking, action, or behavior that they identify with. Underline it in the book. And the second 8 pages, it's a 16-page story, the second 8 pages, underline anything that Bill did to recover from alcoholism, because all the steps are laid out there. Underline anything that Bill did that they are unwilling to do to recover to alcoholism, anything they feel resistance toward. That gives me a good idea of the level of willingness the person is going to have. And I'll tell you what, if somebody's just trying to jerk me around and involve me in their drama, they won't even bother finishing the Bill Wilson exercise, and I will have saved myself a lot of phone calls and time. You know what I mean? Anyway, after doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. If they want to try primal scream therapy, you know, give them your card. Tell them when you're hoarse, give me a call. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that worked with us. We'll point out that we alcoholics have much in common and that you would like, in any case, to be friendly. Let it go at that. The last several weeks, we've been talking about the 12th step. I like looking at the 12th step in three different ways. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, I like to look at that. One of the things that I used to hear a lot in carrying the message up to the VA was, it was invariable, when we were on the 12th step, somebody would raise their hand and say something like, I had my spiritual awakening Thursday talking to Rodney, or something like that. I hated to burst anybody's bubble, but the spiritual awakening that they're talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous is a result of a course of action. The type of awakening that we have is a result of a course of action. Action, reaction. The reaction is the spiritual awakening. I'm not saying that the only way to get spiritual or God consciousness is to follow the course of the steps, but there are certain things that the steps are going to do, certain promises that are to be expected when you follow the course of action laid out in the book. So anyone who hasn't done a fourth and a fifth step, has not done amends, does not follow the tenth step on a daily basis or pray and meditate, is not going to have had the spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, because you can't have something as a result of something that you didn't do. So I look at it the people who have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, I can almost always tell whether they have or not, just because of the light on in their eyes. You know what I mean? You'll see them around the room, and they're usually the type of people who are unflappable. They're always in a good mood, except under real, real serious duress. They're very, very consistent with their meetings. They're very, very consistent working with other people. And their lives seem to be going real well. You know what I mean? The second part of the 12th step I like to look at is, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. Once you've received the spiritual awakening, the next logical step is to try to pass it on to other people. To try to say, you know, I was just like you and I'm not anymore. Let me tell you what's happened. It's the next logical thing. You hear you have to give it away to keep it. You know, I'm not a real big fan of those little slogans like that, but I know that that's what they're talking about. Once you've achieved a certain amount of spirituality through working the program, going to meetings, and being of service, you're going to want to give it away. It's too big of a gift to keep for yourself. And then the third part of the 12th step is to practice the principles in all your affairs. And there's a lot of principles in the book, the main ones being the steps. But I think any instruction in how to live or how to take a spiritual exercise or what type of a prayer to use in certain instances. Anything like that is a principle. And as we mature in recovery, we learn to use the tools or the principles better and better in our lives. And we try to practice them. The chapter Working with Others is specifically on carrying the message to other alcoholics. But the following chapters, I believe, there's four more chapters, I believe that they're real good in showing us how to practice the principles also. I'm going to start reading tonight on the top of page 96. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. That's a great line. Instead of chasing somebody around all the time, you'll see that this is more or less a take it or leave it type of approach that Working with Others lays out for us. We're to lay the kit of spiritual tools at the person's feet, and it's really up to them to pick it up. You can't shove a spiritual life down somebody's throat. They really have to want it. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny another alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. And I've seen a lot of people waste a lot of time on unwilling people. You know what I mean? When you can find willing people in the rooms of AA. I mean, you don't have to go running around the detoxes to try to find people. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Suppose now you are making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Remember what we talked about last week. On the first visit, you bring the big book. And what I like to do is the Bill Wilson exercise. Again, for anybody that wasn't here, you ask the prospect to read Bill's story. They're supposed to read the whole book, but to read Bill's story, underline anything in the first 8 pages that they relate to, drinking, thinking, any behavior, any feelings that you relate to. And in the second 8 pages, underline anything that you feel resistance toward in what he did to recover. Because it's simply laid out in his story what he did to recover. The 12 steps are kind of outlined. So you get the person to underline anything they're not willing to do. They may not be willing to make amends. They may not be willing to do a fifth step, whatever. That doesn't mean they can't go through the program, but that'll give you a good idea of where their willingness lies. Having had the experience yourself, you can give them much practical advice. This basically said right here, if you haven't gone through the 12 steps, you're going to have a hard time explaining the spiritual awakening to your alcoholic prospect. Now, what are you going to tell them? A lot of times we do things like just come to meetings, you know, get in the car and we'll drive you to 90 meetings in 90 days. That's not really what the big book is telling us to do. The big book is telling us to recover so that we can help other people recover. Let him know you are available if he wishes to make a decision to tell his story, the fifth step. But do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. If he wants to go to a priest or something, that's fine. He may be broken, homeless. If he is, you might try to help him about getting a job. I've done that. Or give him a little financial assistance. I shy away from that these days. But you should not deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. Perhaps you will want to take the man into your home for a few days. I've done that too. But be sure you use discretion. Be certain he will be welcomed by your family and that he is not trying to impose upon you for money, connections, or shelter. Permit that and you only harm him. You will be making it possible for him to be insincere. You may be aiding his destruction rather than his recovery. We're talking about enabling. Never avoid these responsibilities, but be sure you're doing the right thing if you assume them. This is an important sentence. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep. That has happened to me, I'll tell you. Great interference with your pleasures. A lot of weekends are taken up doing step work and things like that for me. interruptions to your business. At least once or twice a month, I have to leave my job to go on a 12-step call. Luckily, I have the type of job where I can do that. I can make up the time later. It may mean sharing your money and your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. I've done all of those. I used to think I didn't visit asylums, but I've visited asylums. Those are some grim places, I'll tell you, too. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. 2 o'clock in the morning last week. Your wife may sometimes say she's neglected, quite often, actually. A drunk may smash your furniture in your home, burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. I love that, you know. Yeah. So we're going to be seeing a lot more 12-step work with the closing down of all the rehabs and everything. So, you know, practice up on your boxing. Sometimes you will have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. I also shy away from sedatives, thank you. I'll tell you what, though, many times I've had to buy booze to keep somebody from going into DTs. One 12-step case not that long ago, we were trying to get this person into St. Clair's, and it was the weekend, and nobody showed up there, and there was one guy, and he was being a real asshole. Okay, he didn't want to help us at all. He said, it was like 9 in the morning, and this person is really starting to go into DTs. We're saying, we got to get her in. And he's saying, you can't. You got to wait till the next shift. You got to wait till 5 o'clock tonight. So we had to we bought a pint of vodka and divvied out shots until 5 o'clock that night when we could get that person into the detox. It's not a bad idea if you do a lot of 12-step work to have booze for this purpose. If you say that in a normal discussion meeting, people will jump all over you. I don't keep booze in my house. Well, those are people who don't do a lot of 12-step calls that'll say something like that, because it may mean the difference between life and death for somebody, whether you have it or not. And if you can't have booze in the trunk of your car or in your house, you haven't done enough step work anyway. You know, you've got a for shit program. Not that I judge. Anyway.
Much.
Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally you will have to meet such conditions. We seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our homes for long at a time. It is not good for him, and it sometimes creates serious complications in a family. The person I had living in my house, I had to kindly shove him out after about a month. He was going to stay for good if I let him. He was bringing over a dresser the next day or something. You know? I said, whoa. Though an alcoholic does not respond, there is no reason why you should neglect his family. You should continue to be friendly to them. The family should be offered your way of life. I believe that this is the Al-Anon's job today, but sometimes we're a channel to the Al-Anon's. You know, we may be the only person that they're talking to. Should they accept and practice spiritual principles, there is a much better chance the head of the family will recover. Back in these days, the families would do the steps. They'd get together and they'd do morning meditations together, and they actually did the steps. And I'll tell you what, while your whole family is undergoing a spiritual awakening, it makes it real uncomfortable for you to, like, blackout drink 24 hours a day. One of the things you hear is once the spouse hits Al-Anon, the drinking person's days are numbered. You know what I mean? It's a lot of times it's inevitable. They'll last about a year or two, you know, and then they'll come in, except the real hardcore cases. Even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. So if you practice the steps, this is an amazing thing. If you see people who work in a really good Al-Anon program, they'll vacuum around the drunk passed out on the floor. You know what I mean? Won't even make a difference to them. For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide for each other these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. When you see somebody that's willing, I talked about this last week, when you see somebody that's willing, people in the rooms reach out, and cars appear, and jobs appear, and apartments appear, and stuff like that. But the person that's unwilling and has got a really bad attitude, you know, it's not as easy for them. It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plan, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. There are people that are like that. I was working with a guy. All he wanted was rides to work and to borrow money. And all, I mean, this guy was like a predator in AA. He just wanted things, and he was just bullshitting everybody. He didn't want to work a spiritual program of action. All his scorecards read zero, and he wanted some assistance in that area. You know what I mean? Whenever you see something like that, you got to cut the person off. Some of us have taken very hard knocks and learned this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking, so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. A very important sentence. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home. So what are you supposed to do? Very quickly, you're supposed to make amends at home and explain the 12 steps and how you're going to live those. That is, if he is lucky enough to have a home. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague, and that is a real high order. That is, you know, try practicing that for 30 days. Don't argue or find fault with anybody in your family for the next 30 days, and see how long you last. Right, Rich?
30 minutes.
In many homes, this is a difficult job to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. There's a must. It must be done if any results are to be expected. That's not good news for some of us. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. After they have seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. You know, the way you're acting speaks so loudly, I can't even hear what you're saying. You know what I mean? The only true way to be able to do to 12-step a family or influence a family is by changing yourself. I made big mistakes when I was first sober trying to tell everybody what they should do to recover. First thing I did is I went to my ex-wife and told her she needed Al-Anon because she's an unrecovered codependent. I can imagine what she told me, you know? You're the guy that used to puke on me, and now you're going to tell me how to live. No thank you. Anyway, years later, she did start asking questions when she saw that my life was changed so much. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. There's another tall order. Of course, we all fall much below this standard many times, but we try to repair the damage immediately lest we pay the penalty by a spray. And we ten-step it. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis, since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is in the best interest of all concerned that the couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be laid down. Let the alcoholic continue his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. That just isn't so. That was so for me. My family wasn't coming back. My ex-wife was married with 3 kids. You know? She wasn't going to be coming back. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. I like the way they repeat like 3 times important concepts. And that's one of them. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We've seen others slip when the family came back too soon. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. That's absolutely true. Think of what you wanted out of AA the day you came in. And think today what you've gotten. You know what I mean? You've been overpaid, considering what you wanted to get when you walked through the doors. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do. On one 12-step call, the woman was telling me all the crazy things this guy was doing, and she was afraid that she was going to burn the house down and all this stuff. She said, should I divorce him? I said, I can't answer that. I'm not touching that one with a 10-foot pole. You know what I mean? I can't. You know, you're going to have to answer that one yourself. But urge upon a man's family that he's been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. You should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them that he has entered upon a period of growth. Ask them to remember, when they are impatient, the blessed fact of his sobriety. If you have been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family about what was accomplished. In this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of criticism. And that is a good thing to be able to share. Another one of the paradoxes in AA has been the things I thought that were the worst things that could happen to me ended up becoming my greatest assets. Like divorce or things like that. I've been able to identify with a newcomer or another alcoholic and say, you know, I know how you feel. I've been there. And this too shall pass. And give some experience, you know, share some of my experience and how I got through it, what worked, what didn't work, you know. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. Here's a paragraph that you don't see referred to too much, but I want to qualify it. This book is written in a way where it's really expecting you to take the spiritual exercises as you go along, okay? So this book is assuming at this point that you are on step 12. You have made your amends. You have done your inventories. The way we read the books today is we read the big book like a novel. It's really a workbook. It's really a textbook where you're supposed to do the lessons for the day. You know what I mean? So, I mean, don't run up to a newcomer and say, you know, you can go anywhere where booze is. That's really not true. I believe until you're on step 10, where it promises that you'll be safe and protected from alcohol, you're not safe and protected from alcohol. Especially if you're resting on your laurels. You know what I mean? I was in a vulnerable position for years. I could have drank any time for years, and I just didn't by the grace of God. Because it took me years, really, to get up to step 10. Back in the early 90s of AA around here, where, you know, you didn't hear much about the steps. Anyway, people have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we're to go in their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded of alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. Remember when I judged the people who felt uncomfortable about booze? That's just what the big book says. If you're uncomfortable with booze, you haven't done enough of the step work. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory that he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. You know, that does not work. hiding the bottles on the person does not work. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. Mm. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking. If we have legitimate reason for being there, that includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary old drinking parties.
Whoopee okay, but rem-
whoopee.
That's what a whoopee party is. Anyway, to a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. You will note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going into this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? The person who wants to go back and hang out in the bar for the atmosphere and drink club sodas, he's going to be in trouble. But, I mean, if you, there's a lot of people who do business, you know. Business does not stop. And a lot of business gets done in bars and restaurants where they serve liquor and stuff like that. You just can't expect everybody to start shielding themselves from those environments. That would be ridiculous. But if you can answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. Be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start, and your motive in going is thoroughly good. There's the qualifier again. Mm-hmm. Solid spiritual ground means, I believe, my definition of solid spiritual ground is consistent meetings, working the steps to the best of your ability in your life, and being of service when it's available and appropriate. And that'll put you on solid spiritual ground. It's done so with me. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. I like to look at that as an AA meeting. So many people I hear say like, I didn't get anything out of that meeting. Whatever. I like to look at it as I'm going to bring something to the meeting. Not like I'm going to go there and fill up like it's a spiritual gas station. I think more or less like, who can I go there and talk to? You know, which one of my sponsees will be there? You know, how can I be of service? And that's a real good way to look at going to meetings, rather than, you know, it's a pain in the ass, and, you know, I hope I get something good out of it. You know what I mean? But if you're shaky, you had better work with another alcoholic instead. So if you are shaky and you don't feel comfortable being around alcohol, go work with another alcoholic. Well, I sit with a long face in places where there is drinking, sighing about the good old days. If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means go along, let your friends know. They are not to change their habits on your account. One of the stupid things I did was I tried to sober up my entire work crew the day I got sober. I working with Anthony. All right, there's going to be no more drinking here, guys. That made me real popular, you know. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. If you do this thoroughly, few people will ask you to drink. It does not say, tell everybody you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, explain why drinking is disagreeable to you. So many people say, I'm going to A&A, and they relapse. That makes us look bad, okay? So if you're new or just coming back or something, keep your mouth shut that you're in AA, right? You could kill somebody, you know? Somebody will say, oh, the only guy I ever know that went to A&A drinks like a fish. What good would that do? You know what I mean? So practice a little restraint with your telling everybody you're going to AA. While you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you are getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. Your job is now to... Here's what everybody's job is. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others, so never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. What a great promise. Work with other alcoholics, practice a program, go to meetings, and God will keep you unharmed. You know, alcoholism is too big of a nut for me to crack. It really is. being an alcoholic, the last thing in the world I can do is decide when I'm going to drink. So I have to put myself in the spiritual atmosphere where God can keep me safe and protected. Many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover, and I have it in my home for such a case. I also have a little bit of beer because my mother drinks beer. When she comes over, she likes to have a beer or two or 12. And so I got it there, you know? Believe me, if I thought I was in a place where I'd run downstairs to get a beer because I had a bad day at work, something would really be wrong. Anyway, some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they are not alcoholic, but some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves. We're careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. I think drinking is great. If you can drink and have a good time, God bless you. I'm envious, you know what I mean? Have fun. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. One of the big mistakes the Washingtonians made was they went for temperance. They were a bunch of ex-alcoholics who now wanted to ban liquor. And that didn't make them real popular with the still drinking alcoholics. We would not even do the cause of temperance drinking any good, for not one drinker in a thousand likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. Someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem, and we have. But we should be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. I thought that we would do something different tonight. The chapter to wives is not something that we usually do in this meeting. But it's been on my mind for the last several weeks. One of the things that really prompted my my going back and looking at this chapter was my wife's sister is a serious big book carrying Al-Anon out in Arizona. And I'll tell you, they've got some really great Al-Anon out there. And it's heavily allied with AA. Whenever there's a convention, there's an Al-Anon convention at the same time, you know, there's Al-Anon meetings and AA meetings alongside each other. Very, very powerful area. And something that's going through the meetings in their area at this time is group conscience meetings about whether or not they should use Alcoholics Anonymous literature in their meetings. And for the most part, I hear from her that they're voting it down. They're voting to just allow Al-Anon approved literature in those meetings, and that's got me thinking a lot. And one of the things that it got me back to was the chapter to wives. I'm gonna read just a few parts. I'm not gonna read the whole chapter. I'm gonna read a few parts, mainly the areas that I believe kind of point toward the alcoholic and the alcoholic's experience. And I'll start on page 104, paragraph 2. But for every man who drinks, others are involved: the wife who trembles in fear of the next debauch, the mother and father who see their son wasting away. A little bit down the next paragraph. We want the wives of Alcoholics Anonymous to address the wives of men who drink too much. This is really how they did it back then. They carried the message to the still suffering family member. We're on page 105, halfway through the second paragraph. What I'd like to look at in this is an exercise for you to go to when you're working on your eighth step cards. We have such a great capacity to think that our drinking has only really hurt us. You know, we didn't hurt anybody. We hid in our room and we drank. And to the most part, we're in a lot of denial about just how much damage we've caused with our drinking. And I think it's a good exercise to go to this point in the chapter to wives to turn the statements into questions and ask yourself, you know, is this your experience? Have you caused any of these harms? so that you can add them to your eight-step list. Our men have sworn great solemn oaths that they were through drinking forever. We believed them when no one else could or would. Then in days, weeks, or months, a fresh outburst. We seldom had friends at our homes, never knowing how or when the man of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. We came to live almost alone. When we were invited out, our husbands sneaked so many drinks that they spoiled the occasion. That was me, I'll tell you. I'm not drinking. I'd be on first name basis with the bartender 5 minutes into the place. If, on the other hand, they took nothing, their self-pity made them killjoys. There never was financial security. Positions were always in jeopardy or gone. That is really me. An armored car could not have brought home the pay envelopes. The checking account melted like snow in June. Sometimes there were other women. How heartbreaking was this discovery? How cruel to be told that they understood our men as we did not. The bill collectors, the sheriffs, the angry taxi drivers, the policemen, the bums, the pals, even the ladies, they sometimes brought home. Our husbands thought we were so inhospitable. Joy killer, nag, wet blanket, that's what they said. Next day they would be themselves again and we would forgive and try to forget. Down a little bit. They struck the children, kicked out door panels. I was great for kicking out door panels. Mm-hmm. Smashed treasured crockery. We didn't have any treasured crockery to smash, but I smashed anything that was in front of me. They ripped out the keys of pianos. I love that one. If I had a piano, I probably would have been a key ripper. In the midst of such pandemonium, they may have rushed out threatening to live with the other woman forever. Mm. In desperation, we've even got drunk ourselves, the drunk to end all drunks. The unexpected result was that our husbands seemed to like it. Down at the bottom of the page. We began to ask medical advice as the sprees got closer together. The alarming physical and mental symptoms, the deepening pale of remorse, depression, and inferiority that settled down on our loved ones, these things terrified and distracted us. As animals on a treadmill, we have patiently and wearily climbed, falling back in exhaustion after every futile effort to reach solid ground. Most of us have entered the final stage with its commitment. Most of us have entered the final stage with its commitment to health resorts, sanitariums, hospitals, rehabs, detoxes, and jails. Sometimes there were screaming delirium and insanity, and death was often near. Mm. I put my family through the screaming delirium and insanity. And I'll tell you what, if you care for somebody and you see them going through that, it's a painful thing to watch. Down 107, paragraph 2. And just as we were being convinced of their heartlessness, they would surprise us with fresh resolve and new attentions. For a while, they would be their old sweet selves, only to dash this new structure of affection to pieces once more. How many of us were great at making up the next day after some horrible thing that we did, you know? Time after time after time, putting people through that. Page 108, paragraph 1, a little bit down. Perhaps your husband has been living in that strange world of alcoholism where everything is distorted and exaggerated. You can see that he really does love you with his better self. Down at the bottom. This is great. Down at the very bottom paragraph here, they talk about a heavy drinker and three types of alcoholics in this, and it's really, really great. The oral history of this chapter is that when they were putting the big book together, Bill Wilson believed that one of the AA women should write this chapter. And what the oral history says is that he went to Ann Smith and asked Ann Smith if she would write the chapter to wives. And she declined. So Bill Wilson decided to write it himself. And if you study the big book as much as I do, you'll see that it's definitely Bill Wilson's writing. It's unmistakably Bill in this chapter. And Lois forever held a resentment that she wasn't asked. He never asked his own wife. Anyway, let's go down to the bottom here. The problem with which you struggle usually falls within one of four categories. So they're describing the different alcoholics to the wives here. One, your husband may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant or it may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. The world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. Some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. Again, it's very, very important to understand what makes an alcoholic and what doesn't. A lot of times if you go to a rehab for your third DWI or something, they stamp you on the forehead upon admission that you're an alcoholic. That may or may not be true. You may be a heavy drinker. You may have screwed your life up big time. You may have the habit of drinking. But there were several people I went to rehab with who were just heavy drinkers, because they're fine today. They were detoxed. They went through as much of the program as they could stand. They got out. They did not go to AA meetings, because AA meetings were not for them. And they're fine. They're sober. They may not be the happiest people in the world, but they have had no trouble staying away from alcohol for about 10 years now. You know, they are not what we would call an alcoholic. Number two, your husband is showing lack of control, for he's unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe he's beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried at times and is becoming aware that he cannot drink like other people. He sometimes drinks in the mornings and through the day also to hold his nervousness in check. He is remorseful after serious drinking bouts and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately next time. We think this person is in danger. These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say among ourselves, he wants to want to stop. Many, many people come into Alcoholics Anonymous at this level now. They didn't used to when the Big Book was written. You used to really have to have gone through asylums and everything else. But the door is open for alcoholic number two here. And that's actually a good thing. You can save yourself many years of suffering. Three, this husband has gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, he became worse. His friends have slipped away, his home is in a near wreck, and he cannot hold the position. Maybe the doctor has been called in, and the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals, rehabs, and detoxes has begun. He admits he cannot drink like other people, but he does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so, still suffering from the delusion. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop but cannot. His case presents additional questions which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. It's a funny thing. The worse the alcoholic gets, the more desperate they are to get better, because the worse their bottom is. You know, action is really the way to recover from alcoholism. And until you've got a bottom sufficient to convince you to take actions which you don't believe in and don't think will work for you and especially don't want to take, until you become convinced to do that, there's little or no hope of permanent, successful, happy recovery. Alcoholic number four. You may have a husband of whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk. This really was me. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. Perhaps he's had delirium tremens. Doctors may shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you've already been obliged to put him away. Remember, this is back in the 30s when you could sign somebody away. All you'd have to do is get a couple of doctor's signatures and Uncle Harry was gone. You know what I mean? Go see him at Christmas. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they got well. All right, let's go to page 112, paragraph 3. They're talking about how the wife approaches the alcoholic after a binge. But after his next binge, ask him if he would really like to get over drinking for good. Do not ask that he do it for you or anyone else, just would he like to? The chances are he would. Show him your copy of this book and tell him what you found out about alcoholism. This is paralleling a lot of the information in working with others, by the way. Show him that as alcoholics, the writers of the book understand. Tell him some of the interesting stories you've read. If you think he will be shy of a spiritual remedy, ask him to look at the chapter on alcoholism. Then perhaps he will be interested enough to continue. And if you remember, the chapter on alcoholism really paints us into a corner. If he is enthusiastic, your cooperation will mean a great deal. If he is lukewarm or thinks he's not an alcoholic, we suggest you leave him alone. Avoid urging him to follow our program. The seed has been planted in his mind. He knows that thousands of men, much like himself, have recovered, but don't remind him of this after he had been drinking, for he may be angry. Sooner or later, you're likely to find him reading the book once more. Wait until repeated stumbling convinces him he must act, for the more you hurry him, the longer his recovery may be delayed. I got a 12-step phone thing a couple of nights ago. Somebody handed me a phone number and said, call this guy, his brother's an alcoholic. He just got his third DWI and he's ruining his family and everything. So I called the brother. The brother really didn't have a lot of information on alcoholism or anything. But basically what I told him was, I told him what this chapter and what the chapter working with others lays out. I said, wait till his next binge. I go, wait till he burns the top half of the house down or gets his fourth DWI. You really need to catch him when he's remorseful, because the person right now has been sober on his own willpower 8 days. And usually the guy who's sober on his own willpower 8 days knows it all and doesn't need any help. The best time to approach such an individual is after he's fallen on his face a few more times. And I said, just give him my phone number and or call me, and I'll have some people come talk to him. He's been in AA in Connecticut for a while, but going to AA meetings does not necessarily mean that you've gotten the message. You know, sometimes you really need a decent 12-step call. I don't care how long you've been in AA, you may not have heard it. There are dark tunnel meetings galore around here where everything, you know, you'd faint if you heard about AA in those meetings. You know what I mean? It's all about feelings and issues. Not that I judge. Anyway. Page 114, too. You may have the reverse situation on your hands. Perhaps you have a husband who is at large, but who should be committed. Mm-hmm. Some men cannot or will not get over alcoholism. When they become too dangerous, we think it is a good thing to lock them up. But of course, a good doctor should always be consulted. The wives and children of such men suffer horribly, but not more than the men themselves. I love that. You can tell it was written by an alcoholic. You know what I mean? We do suffer, though. Page 116, paragraph 3. As our husbands begin to apply spiritual principles in their lives, we begin to see the desirability of doing so. At first, some of us did not believe we needed this help. This is the going through the steps for the family members. We thought on the whole we were pretty good women, capable of being nicer if our husbands stopped drinking, but it was a silly idea that we were too good to need God. Now we try to put spiritual principles to work in every department in our lives. When we do that, we find it solves our problems too. The ensuing lack of fear, worry, and hurt feelings is a wonderful thing. So, for the alcoholic family member, if they practice the steps, they get rid of fear, worry, and hurt feelings. We urge you to try our program, for nothing will be so helpful to your husband as the radically changed attitude toward him, which God will show you how to have. Go along with your husband if you possibly can. That is great. And I'm really sorry that they can't read this in Arizona AA meetings anymore. You know what I mean? Or at least in that area. That's some powerful stuff. Page 118, paragraph 1. You and your husband will find that you can dispose of serious problems easier than you can trivial ones. Next time you and he have a heated discussion, no matter what the subject, it should be the privilege of either to smile and say, "This is getting serious. I'm sorry I got disturbed. Let's talk about it later." I've since put this into practice in the last year or two with arguments with Mary Beth. And sometimes she doesn't want to quit, you know, she's on a roll. But I'll tell you, when we can do it, it's absolutely marvelous. It cools everything right off. If your husband is trying to live on a spiritual basis, he will also be doing everything in his power to avoid disagreement or contention. Remember that? That was the raising the bar part of the program, practicing the principles at home, the last frontier. Page 119, paragraph 1. Still another difficulty is that you may be jealous of the attention he bestows on other people, especially alcoholics. You have been starving for his companionship, yet he spends long hours helping other men and their families. You feel he should now be yours. This happens to so many alcoholics when they get sober. All of a sudden, they're clamoring, their family is clamoring for them to stay home all the time. The fact is that he should work with other people to maintain his own sobriety. Sometimes he will be so interested that he becomes really neglectful. Your house will be filled with strangers. You may not like some of them. He gets stirred up about their troubles, but not about yours. It will do little good if you point that out and urge more attention for yourself. I'll tell you what, a lot of alcoholics get sober and allow what sobriety has given them, like renewed family life and things like that, to take them away from AA, and they fall on their ass and the whole deal starts over again. I believe in the saying that you can't have recovery unless you make it the number one priority, and you can't keep it unless it stays your number one priority. And some people will say, yeah, but I love my family. Well, if sobriety isn't above your family, your family's going to suffer and you're probably going to lose it. And if recovery isn't above your job, if you think your job is more important than recovery, you're probably going to get drunk and lose your job anyway. So that's how I feel. For the last many weeks, we've been going up through the big book to chapter 9 here. We're going to start on chapter 9 tonight. And I like to look at the chapters after working with others as the practice the principles chapters. You find a lot of information in how to handle situations in a sober manner. There's a lot of great additional information. And there's so many big book studies stop at working with others. I think you lose a lot by skipping those chapters. There's so much good stuff in them. I know that when I first came across this chapter, I said the family afterward. I don't have a family afterward. My family is gone, you know. My family's split years before I stopped drinking. But there's still a lot of great information in here. I had a lot of rebuilding to do. I had an ex-wife and I had a daughter who literally had moved to Colorado to get away from me because they were afraid what I would do in my drunken blackouts. And, you know, there was just a whole lot of stuff that I needed to do to start rebuilding that. And a lot of the concepts, a lot of the philosophy that I used to try to set right the wrongs that I had caused, I found in some of these following chapters in how to live a sober life and how to relate to my fellow man, which were tools really I didn't have. I lived by the fight or flight method of survival. You know what I mean? Anyway, let's start on chapter 9, the family afterward. I love this, our women folk. You know, I'll tell you what, so a lot of people have tried to degendrify, is that the proper term? Degendrify the big book. But they've made decisions at the general service level to leave the text alone. I believe the reason is if you open the door to taking some of the sexist terminology out, you might open the door to taking the recovery part out. You know what I mean? They might find a different way of recovery in Southern California or something and try to put it into the big book. So our women folk have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with the husband who is recovering. Perhaps they created the impression that he is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves a process of deflation. The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitude towards himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. We find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. And why? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? They're bringing us right back to the third step description of us, which is basically the actor who wants to play the director. And it's not only true of the alcoholic. It can be true of the family, the alcoholic family too. Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he can take from the family life rather than give? Cessation from drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. A doctor said to us, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic. The entire family is, to some extent, ill. And that's really true. One of the saddest things I see is an alcoholic gets sober and then say, oh man, I'm too sober to live in this family. You know? They're sober like 6 months and they're ready to get a divorce. To a great degree, the alcoholic has caused the emotional illness in the family. The alcoholism and the problems that happen with the family a lot of times are a direct result of the alcoholic's behavior. So if you really look at the program never says, you know, get the hell out of there and start somewhere new. It says, you know, set right the wrongs that you've made in the past. And sometimes that's a tough road. But I'll tell you what, one of the sad things that I see is I see more divorce when people get sober than before they get sober in AA. That's just my personal experience, seeing it in the rooms. How many people get divorced in their first 5 years of recovery? It's unbelievable. Let families realize as they start their journey that all will not be fair weather. Each in his turn may be foot sore and may straggle. There will be alluring shortcuts and bypass down which they may wander and lose their way. Suppose we tell you some of the obstacles a family will meet. Suppose we suggest how they may be avoided, even converted to good use for others. The family of an alcoholic longs for the return of happiness and security. They remember when father was romantic, thoughtful, and successful. That does not describe me. I'll tell you what, so many people come into AA and they had a good life before alcoholism started screwing them up. I started drinking so early, alcohol didn't let me get a good life going, you know? Didn't let me get a good job, didn't let me get a home, didn't let me get a car that wasn't 15 years old. Today's life is measured against that of other years, and when it falls short, the family may be unhappy. Family confidence in dad is rising high. The good old days will soon be back, they think. Sometimes they demand that dad bring them back instantly. God, they believe, almost owes this recompense on a long overdue account, but the head of the house has spent years in pulling down the structures of business, romance, friendship, and health. These things are now ruined or damaged. It will take time to clear away the wreckage. The old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones. The new structures will take years to complete. And that's true. And I'll tell you what, you can go through the steps in a relatively short period of time, but there is something that only time is going to give you in recovery. There's a certain type of wisdom and experience that is only going to come from time. Now and then, the family will be plagued by specters from the past, for the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny and humiliating, shameful and tragic. The first impulse will be to bury these skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. The family may be possessed by the idea that the future happiness can be based only on forgetfulness of the past. We think that such a view is self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. I truly believe that. And I love to hear someone share their experience. I have learned rather late in recovery and in my sobriety to distinguish between someone's opinion and someone's experience. And I think it's very, very important to be able to develop that skill. I'll give you an example. You hear a lot of times people say things like, here's a good one, Dave will like this, that you do a fourth and a fifth step and you go out and you make amends, you do that once, you never have to do that again, and you live in 10, 11, and 12. Now, they've done it once, and that's what they're doing. But what I do, what I try to do, and what I try to promote among the people I sponsor is to go through the steps once a year or so. You know, everybody's got different time signals. But to go through the steps, go through steps 1 through 9 on a continuing basis throughout their recovery, and the rest of the year use, well, the whole year actually, use 10, 11, and 12 to live on a daily basis. Now, the people who tell you you only do it once will say, that's bullshit, you only have to do it once. That's an opinion, because it's not based on the experience that they've tried both ways. You know, if you try both ways, if you try going through the steps every year for a couple of years and using 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, and you still believe that the best way to do it is to only do it once, I'll listen to you then. But you're just giving an opinion based on an experience that you don't have if you're telling me different. Because it's my experience that it's a better way to go and do annual or semi-annual house cleanings. Okay, and that's an example where experience will really talk. A lot. Again, here's another one of my favorites. Have you ever been in a step meeting where somebody says this, like at a 9-step meeting? Well, I've never formally done this step, but I'm about to talk for about 7 minutes on my opinion. Have you ever been in a meeting like that? Okay. Well, the person that shares right after that says, you know, here's a bunch of my current amends and the experiences I've had in my current amends. Who are you going to listen to? The person that's never done the step but is going to tell you what it's all about? Or the person who has gone through the step and has experience to share? You know what I mean? I've been able to discern the difference, in the meetings today. And, you know, it's really not my place to criticize the people who are doing it wrong or whatever, you know. But I have truly found that opinions can kill and experience can really help. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. What a thing that was to learn, that the most horrible things that I did, I can use them as a tool to carry the message to another alcoholic and allow that other alcoholic to identify and sometimes feel like they're not as bad as me, because I've got some bad ones in the closet, you know? And if I can pull them out of the closet and put them on the table when I'm relating to another alcoholic to help them relate, it's really a seriously powerful tool. And it's a priceless asset. And then on the other hand, some of the things I thought that were great assets, like my dark, deep, sensitive, artistic sense of humor and personality, I thought that was like my most important asset coming in here. That was going to kill me, you know what I mean? Being different like that. Anyway, this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problems. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. That is so true. These are all great promises. Cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. It's a powerful thing. Is it possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague? For example, we know of situations in which the alcoholic or his wife have had love affairs. In the first flush of spiritual experience, they forgave each other and drew closer together. The miracle of reconciliation was at hand. Then, under one provocation or another, the aggrieved one would unearth the old affair and angrily cast its ashes about. A few of us have had these growing pains, and they hurt a great deal. I usually tell people who are about to go through their amends, and they've got their sexual harms on the amends list, I tell them they really need to be careful about the details. And if they are willing to go into the specific details, they better be willing to accept the fact that they will be angrily cast into their faces for probably the rest of the relationship's life. You know what I mean? It's certainly possible. Every time there's a heated argument, to hear all the way back, you know, to when you were 19 and you ran off with Daisy Cunningham or some shit. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you really have to be careful with that stuff. It says, you know, I would say you need to do it more in a general way. Husband and wives have sometimes been obliged to separate for a time until a new perspective, new victory over hurt pride could be re-won. In most cases, the alcoholic survived this ordeal without relapse, but not always. So we think that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. We families of Alcoholics Anonymous keep few skeletons in the closet. Everyone knows about the other alcoholic troubles. This is a condition which, in ordinary life, would produce untold grief. There might be scandalous gossip, laughter at the expense of other people, and a tendency to take advantage of intimate information. If I went up to the guys I work with and told some of the story that I tell from the podium, they probably wouldn't want to work with me anymore, you know? talk about vomiting straight up and, you know, knowing how to roll out of the way real quick and going through the front windshield, the passenger windshield, and the back windshield of the only windshield I haven't been thrown out of is the driver's side. I mean, if I start telling some of these stories, they're going to just look at me like I'm nuts. You know what I mean? I remember trying to explain to some of the guys at work one time what an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was all about. You know, well, what's it all about? Well, we all get together and we say the serenity prayer in the meeting, and then they'll start the meeting, and it'll be on resentments, and someone will raise their hand and talk about their resentment. And then for the rest of the hour, everybody will sit there and talk about their resentments that they've had. And then at the end, we'll all hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And that's how I stay sober. You know? Well, how does that work? Well, it works pretty good. I mean, they look at you like you're out of your mind. Among us, these are rare occurrences. We do talk about each other a great deal, but we almost invariably temper such talk by a spirit of love and tolerance. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. We find it better when possible to stick to our own stories. A man may, except after the meeting, there's a rule that you can talk about people after the meeting, after you have had your coffee. A man may criticize or laugh at himself, and it will affect others favorably, but criticism or ridicule coming from another often produces the contrary effect. Members of a family should watch such matters carefully, for one careless, inconsiderate remark has been known to raise the very devil. We alcoholics are sensitive people. You know it. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. I am very sensitive. You can hurt my feelings in the blink of a hat. I'm telling you. Many alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes. At the beginning of recovery, a man will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He may either plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks and thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we have had experience galore. That really is true. Some people get totally involved in AA and get way out of balance with the rest of their life. Some people go, I'm sober now. I've thrown away all my money for the past 20 years. I'm going to play catch up. And they work 16 hours a day. It's very important to find balance. One of my jobs as a sponsor is to guide people with their unhealthy balances, and to kind of point them in the right direction when they get out of balance, because it's very easy to do. I mean, I can do it.